Every year, Americans eat more than 10 billion farm-raised animals. In order to keep up with this demand, factory farming practices have often become more inhumane and unhealthy for the animals and unsustainable for the environment. Patrick Martins, the founder of Slow Food USA and Heritage Foods USA, believes that we have evolved to be meat eaters, but that carnivores need to make better, more informed choices about where the meat that we eat comes from and how our food is raised. Mr. Martins also runs Heritage Radio Network out of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. His new book is called The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat, published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased that it has brought Patrick Martins to our show today. Hello.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Many vegetarians point out that they think a meat-free diet is the best for animals on the planet. What's your response?
I mean, we eat 10 billion livestock a year. So I think animals have suffered longer for more decades in this country because we keep asking that question, should we eat meat, shouldn't we? Meanwhile, we're eating millions of hamburgers a day. So it's better to construct an action-based approach. When I work with Slow Food, I learned from Carlo Petrini, the founder, action. You need projects. You need to do things. So I believe in creating a solution rather than talking about some utopia that will probably never exist.
Well, we are omnivores. So if we are vegetarians, we are ignoring a part of what our bodies are set up to digest. Mm-hmm. But many people feel that we should be eating a lot less meat than we eat, even if we do eat meat.
Yes, and there are 50 essays in this book, and many of them are actually very critical of industrial agriculture because of how they've kind of fast-forwarded the process of raising livestock. One of the chapters is called Survival of the Fattest, not Survival of the Fittest. And when you do slow the processes down, the meat is going to cost more. So we believe the best way of getting people to eat less meat is by having it cost a little bit more.
Whenever improving what and how we eat comes up, elitism is also mentioned. Are we talking about elitist ideas here?
Well, I mean, this is my answer to that question. I take the turkey as an example, the turkey that 99.9% of all Americans eat every day. That turkey has had a series of things happen to it that are unnatural and unjust. They clip their beaks so that they can eat faster. They're kept indoors, crowded into large barns. They never see the light of day. They're actually forced to grow so fast that their skeletal and cardiovascular systems can't keep up. They arrive to the slaughterhouse already a little bit in pain. That's why they need antibiotics in their food. You know, it's just to keep them alive during their kind of short, miserable lives. So who are we telling to eat that cheap turkey to? Poor people? That never really made any sense to me. I think if you and I know to go to the farmer's market and eat the best turkey, a poor person should be told the same thing. Eat the best turkey. Don't eat the worst one, especially if it's unhealthy.
So you're suggesting we should be eating heritage turkeys?
Well, more expensive, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free meat. You know, with cameras in the slaughterhouses, Michael Pollan called for glass slaughterhouse. Yes, we should be eating the very best meat, but less of it.
Aren't we moving in an opposite direction in some places with ag-gag laws being enacted in a number of states?
Yes, but, on the other side, there are a number of farmers markets. You were just mentioning the two that you like to go to, and I do think that people are starting to be more concerned about the ethics of industrial meat eating.
Is it just ethics to the turkeys that are raised the other way, the way that you approve of? Do they taste better?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, they have better muscle structure. They haven't been fed medicine. So, I mean, they can survive in nature. One of the funny stories that we tell in one of the chapters is that presidential pardoned turkey actually dies a few weeks after just of natural causes at a very young age because it's not a healthy animal. It cannot survive in nature. So we believe that, people should be eating, the real best and really traceability, knowing where it comes from.
But as you've pointed out, high-quality meat is also more expensive. Does that keep it out of reach for many people?
Well, I mean, if it does, then maybe that's not such a bad thing, as we were just saying. But, I lived in Italy for 2 years, and I noticed how, 2 ounces of ground pork or, you know, ground beef spread over pasta sauce, that actually only comes to $2 or $3 a person, a portion. So their recipes, you know, Italian culture is basically famous for, you know, serving very delicious food very cheaply. And one of the chapters and throughout the book, we call for the consumption of more ground meat. Because when you grind up animals, it makes it easier for the farmers to sell all the cuts, and it's the lowest portion cost in the food world for meat.
I have been told by a number of people in the Chinese community that the way you can tell whether a chef just came over from China or has been here a long time is by looking at the proportion of meat to the vegetables in any given dish. In China, it would be seen as one of many ingredients, mm-hmm. a flavoring ingredient. But in the United States, even the Chinese have come to expect the pork or the chicken or the beef or whatever to be the predominant ingredient.
Yes, all the more reason to engage in constructive projects that create to get more farms to be producing more of the meat we eat and to have less animal suffering. I mean, I got into heritage foods and partially slow food and partially written this book because animals suffer. On industrial farms. And, you know, Temple Grandin has been calling for this. Carlo Petrini has been calling for this. Everyone's been calling for it. And yet we don't really see slaughterhouses opening outside cities. We don't really see that much change. Although there's a lot of hope. I mean, Nyman started in the 80s. My friend Mark Ladner, who is the chef of Del Posto, has just kickstarted his pasta flyer project, which is going to make ground meat and pasta fast food, serve slow, slow ingredients all throughout the Northeast on college campuses. So change is happening.
I heard a report, an NPR report just recently, that Americans spend a smaller percentage of their incomes on food than any other country in the world. Mm-hmm. We can understand that in countries where people make very little. But even in countries where the standard of living is very high, is it because we have instituted policies to keep food as cheap as possible?
Yeah, subsidies is a big part of it. But, you know, and there's a lot of reasons. I mean, farmers are paid money to not grow corn. And there are all these kinds of projects that help small farms. We're big believers in the kind of grassroots effort. My mentors are Carlo Petrini, who started Slow Food from Nothing. I studied with
Alice. He started as a protest against McDonald's in Rome.
Yes. And it grew into an international movement with 100,000 members. Alice Waters started Chez Panisse in her kitchen and is now that's credited as the foundation of the organic movement in 1971, or one of them. And so, you know, we believe in a hamburger grill in Bushwick, Brooklyn, more than we do in trying to lobby the government to try to help animals suffer less.
My guest is Patrick Martins. His book, The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat, written with the help of Mike Edison and published by Little Brown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many people have pointed out that fast food and processed foods are a lot less expensive, usually, but they're also not always good for our health. So in the end, we wind up paying more when we have to go to the doctor.
Yeah, and, you know, listen, we have a chapter, like I say, there are 50 short essays. I mean, this is about a slow turning of the wheel. I mean, I had a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich for breakfast, and I know that bacon came from a cruel system. But, you know, it's not about a utopic society. It's about a slow turning of the wheel. And one of the things we hope is that the big industrial complexes start to slowly turn the wheel. Bigger houses for the chickens, more room for pigs, who are very curious animals, and they have absolutely zero outlet for their curious nature on industrial farms. So, you know, if everyone steers the wheel a little bit in the right direction, the world would be a better place. And as this greatest country in the history of the world, we should be treating our animals with the utmost respect, not with the least.
I mentioned that Carlo Petrini started Slow Food in Italy as a way of protesting the growth of fast food chains in Europe, mm-hmm. McDonald's, et cetera. to some degree, was even seen as an anti-American movement. So how does that apply in this country?
Well, I
do
mean,
we have to be self-hating Americans to be supporters of slow food?
No, but, you know, there should be certain checks and balances. I mean, these boardrooms, I mean, these guys at Purdue and Smithfield, I mean, these are not, they're put profit way ahead of anything. I mean, they've cut the growing time of a chicken by 75%. They've cut in half the natural growth time of a pig. It's just not right. And, you know, we're not saying that, you know, they should put cameras in slaughterhouses and have guys like me watching it, but third-party arbiters, Temple Grandin, a lot of people agree with this, and I think congressmen, you know, don't have any real incentive to make change if those are the people giving them the money.
We did a show not that long ago about how much of the chicken market and pig market a company like Tyson controls, mm-hmm. and now they're moving into beef as well. Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem that just one or two companies are supplying us with the great majority of our food?
There's less competition, certainly slaughterhouses. There's less slaughterhouses. There's less independent farmers. And the big problem, as this book talks, one of the chapters is called Eaten Endangered Species, is when you have a few companies control the whole system, you have basically they push out all the varieties, other varieties of chickens and cows. So people might not know that just like there are different types of dogs and cats, there are different types of pigs and turkeys and ducks and geese. And it's important for a safe food supply, a diverse food supply, that they're all raised. And there are many breeds on the brink of extinction, and their census counts, like the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy is a great one. They keep census counts of all these endangered breeds. And ironically, we have to eat them in order to save them.
Hasn't that been the way of farming for a very, very long time, not just in America? Cows were bred to produce more milk mm-hmm. quicker. Pigs were bred to be give us bigger butts so that we can have mm-hmm. more bacon. The turkeys, you point out, are bred to have bigger breasts mm-hmm. because people like a lot of white meat when they eat their turkey.
Yes, farmers have always bred for certain characteristics, but a good farmer and one that we should be supporting is one that breeds for balance, because there's basically three things, you know, ability to reproduce, ability to survive in nature and walk around and get along, when you know, the ability to be, you know, even, not to have an unduly large breast. And so when you push one to go too fast, the other two suffer. And that doesn't even cover the taste thing. Taste always suffers when you're pushing an animal to only have one characteristic.
How did you start Heritage USA?
Heritage Foods USA? Slow Food USA's most engaging project still to this day. And they have a new executive director, Richard McCarthy, who's doing a great job pushing that project. It's called the Arc of Taste. And onto that metaphorical arc, they board endangered foods. The kinds have been pushed aside because of industry or apathy.
What you're calling heritage breeds?
Heritage breeds.
Are they similar to heirloom vegetables?
Absolutely. Heirloom and heritage are the same. You know, heritage is the word we picked for meats, as people know about heirloom. But there are different types of eggplants that are endangered. There could even be brewing styles that are endangered. And so the way you help these things not be endangered is to grow more of them. To sell more of it. You got to sell them to save them, in a way.
Well, haven't we seen something of a reversal in recent years? I know when I go to the green market, there are potatoes in every color. There are mm-hmm. carrots now in every color, radishes. Have we been reversing things, or is that just a niche market?
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that the slow food movement or the organic movement, you know, hasn't really taken hold. The locavore movement hasn't really taken hold, and that it's not really changing.
Well, I'm sorry for interrupting, but I was just thinking along those lines. You go to the farmer's market and there are local strawberries, mm-hmm. and then you go into your local supermarket and there are the Driscoll strawberries that have been shipped in from California. You mm-hmm. would think that the local supermarkets would be carrying local strawberries, which taste better and mm-hmm. were just picked. But and don't cost as much to ship.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, one of the chapters is called Slow Business, Part 1, Meet Me in the Middle. And it talks about the extinction of an empowered middle manager. In the old days, I grew up in New York City in the 70s. That guy at the market could stand outside and buy stuff off of a truck. He could make a deal by knowing his field. Today, a lot of those buying decisions at supermarkets are made by, you know, know, corporate hubs in a very far away place. And those people, you know, don't necessarily know what the best pork is or the best apples to serve it with. But one thing you did say that makes me think, one of the things, chapters that some people are like, well, what does this mean? We have to hell with local, eat the best. Sometimes I think local food is not always the best, but it is bought. And that's one of the things I think the locavore movement suffers from. Those things don't always taste the best. And I think if this country is ever going to be like France or Italy, it needs to see itself as a gastronomic mosaic. The best places for peaches are Georgia, Western Michigan, Ohio. It's not New York State. So maybe New York State should be, we should be rewarding producers to raise things that are best for this environment rather than just saying this cheese is great if it's really a fourth-rate product. The goal is that everyone raise the best things that they can, not the third best thing.
Okay. And then there are other things like bananas and oranges and lemons,
coffee,
and limes that just can't grow in our area.
So it's important to buy the best of those. And, you know, local is just a distance. It's not a taste. And Carlo Petrini's always called for gastronomy to be viewed as its own individual science, like psychology and sociology, with truths and rights and wrongs. And so we hope more people eat better tasting food. That's the best thing that the best foods have, is their taste. So
something you said reminded me about something that Dan Barber said when he was a guest on the show recently. He said that farming needs more middlemen, not just the farmers that grow wheat, but also people who mill it and distribute it and sell it. It gets more people involved and spreads the wealth. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. One of the chapters is called Merchants Matter, and I talked about Steve Jenkins, one of the founders of Fairway and the guy who first introduced great European cheeses to the United States from Europe. I talked about one of my competitors, Ariane Degas from D'Artagnan. I talked about my wife, Anne Saxelby, and Saxelby Cheesemongers, although I didn't mention it by name. It is very important if small farms are going to go from small to middle size, that they end up working with people who, you know, help them distribute it. Because just because you're a great farmer doesn't mean that you should also be asked to man a farmer's market stand 12 hours a day. That's asking a lot.
My guest is Patrick Martins. He has written, with the help of Mike Edison, The Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. It's published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Patrick Martins, who is and sees himself as an agent for change. He is founder of Slow Foods USA, also Heritage Foods USA, and he has the Heritage Radio Network, which airs daily news coverage on all things food, also 30 hours of original programming a week. And now he's written a book called The Carnivore's Manifesto with Mike Edison, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. It's published by Little Brown. A listener calls in and says she can't afford organic meats. So are the ones without antibiotics and hormones okay? She buys those at the supermarket.
Organic, I think it's a good question. Organic is not exactly the right word term to be looking for with meats. I think the best is, you know, what breed is it? If someone can say this is 100% Angus or 100% Duroc.
We usually don't get that information.
We usually don't, which is why there's certain butchers, you know, Otto Minelli and Sons, the Meat Hook, the Heritage Meat Shop, Dixon's Market, at Chelsea Market. They are places to go. If you live in a different place that doesn't have that, there are mail order companies, Heritage Foods USA, Zingerman's. There are all these ways of getting the best, but it is important whenever possible to not just go to the supermarket and buy industrially raised meat, because, like I say, the antibiotic issue, the ethical issue, there are a lot of things wrong. The pollution, the way they deal with the animal waste often, and paying a relative pittance of a fine. I mean, there's a lot going on.
You mentioned Temple Grandin. So do you also extend that to the way they're slaughtered? Does that affect the taste?
Yes. I mean, if they are worried, if they're scared at the very end, you know, of their lives, they end up developing a certain enzyme that affects the taste. You know, I think Temple's done great things. Unfortunately, huge companies that really kind of commit crimes against the animals can now claim Temple as an advocate. And I think that's great that she, what she's done. But now it's important that she continues her work all the way down the system. She's been calling for cameras in slaughterhouses for decades now. We have more cameras in outer space than we do where 10 billion livestock are produced each year.
Some people argue that sustainable farming is fine for some, but that it's not possible to feed the world that way, that industrial agriculture and GMOs are necessary to keep us, keep up with the demand for food. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, I don't think the current system is feeding everybody. So, I mean, as long as both of us are not. And the other thing is we're talking about, you know, small victories. We're talking about Heritage Foods that does 200 pigs a week and 10,000 turkeys a year. We're talking about, like I said, Mark Ladner's pasta flyer. You know, way down the line, could it feed everybody? I think the answer is yes. We have huge, you know, tall grass prairie land. Wes Jackson and this, you know, his land institute in Salina, Kansas has been calling for a return to permaculture where animals are raised, you know, basically, and eat the earth's grass, the earth's grass that are produced in the absence of row crop agriculture that depletes the topsoil. So we have a lot of land in this country and in the world. And, you know, that's so far down the line. That is also an academic question that I think doesn't affect what I'm trying to do, which is go from 200 pigs a week to 400 pigs a week.
Pigs are raised locally, so are beef cattle and chickens. Are they? Do they taste as good as the ones that are growing or living on prairie lands? Is that guy who has been fighting the U.S. government over whether he should pay for grazing lands? Is he producing better tasting?
That guy. Yeah. I can't believe any good taste is coming out of that place. Yeah, Clive and something. But now the I say that the there's two things that I think create food. One is terroir. That is the earth, the soil speaking to the food. So I think the tall grass prairie produces great tasting grass-fed beef. Another word I invented is one of the chapters in the book is the French for head, tête. It's terroir. And it's the knowledge of the mind. It's, you know, what soil is to the food, terroir is to the mind. And it's passed on from a creative person to a creative person. And I think the terroir of American farmers is growing. And more farmers are being taught about different breeds and their growing cycles and how they need to be breeding. I mean, you know, which turkey are you going to pick out of your flock to be the Tom to breed the next generation? That's terroir. That's knowledge. It's not soil-based. It's mind-based. And I think as it grows, food is tasting better. There are a number of great farms at the farmer's market that raise heritage breeds. But genetics does matter. It's not just about how it's raised. If you raise, like I say, that presidentially pardoned turkey locally, it's still not going to taste that great. It's about care, but it's also about, is it a Berkshire? Is it an Angus? Is it Piedmontese? Is it Narragansett? Questions like that.
You list a few of the great American terroirs, including the South. People know how to do these things better in the South. American beer, Vermont, independent fishermen, the Amish.
Well, these are, again,
all fonts of knowledge that have been passed on from generation to generation.
Yeah, what we like to say about New York City, not much grows here except talent. And, you know, we make the best bagels. The Amish, you know, they might grow on food on great land, but really there is a terroir passed on, a culture of farming, you know, that's very close to their religion. Beer, with rare exception, is not a place-dependent product. So you can make German beer in America, in France, or in Germany, and it could taste the same. So that is knowledge. It's the person. It's the terroir of the mind, basically.
Are there certain cities in this country? You mentioned New York. Kansas City is another one you mentioned.
Portland.
New Orleans.
New Orleans we have in there. I mean, they do. Where else can you get great jambalaya? In New York, Vegas, you just can't. You have to go to that city because there is certain fish, you know, coming out of the Gulf, but there's what to do with it, how to do it, how to prepare it. And you basically have to live there. And tetwar, I just figured we needed a word that talks about people and not only land. I mean, not everyone even knows terroir, so tetwar probably will come in the future, but it's important, expertise, to acknowledge expertise where it exists.
You mentioned Alice Waters and Carlo Petrini, mm-hmm. But you also write about Ted Turner.
Mm-hmm.
How was he a food visionary?
Well, you know, 1 in 9 bison live on Ted Turner lands in this country. He has started the Endangered Species Fund to improve the destinies, not just of humans, but of all species. He's basically, he was at one time the largest landowner in America. I think now he's still probably the 3rd or 4th or 5th. And I have great respect for this. He started Ted's Montana Grill, a national bison chain, you know, understanding that essential irony of the Carnivore's Manifesto, that you have to eat them in order to save them. So it's funny, because of his unusual style and as my co-writer Mike Edison likes to say, because of his failed bid to overtake professional wrestling and other things like that, people forget that he is actually one of the most important food people in American history, especially what he's done with the bison. I mean, that is huge. People might not know there were only 541 bison in America still alive in 1901. So it's important that we eat this natural, free-ranging animal.
We almost hunted them into extinction.
Yeah, 541. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. That is literally how many were left.
Well, we had a lot of buffalo in Italy. They make mm-hmm. great buffalo mozzarella. How come we don't have great buffalo mozzarella being made in this country?
No tetwar.
Christine in Connecticut left a comment on our show page saying, "We don't even have a slaughterhouse in Connecticut. So even if you wanted to start a farm to grow meat, the barrier to entry regarding the slaughter process is prohibitive. Is the locavore movement facing an infrastructure problem?"
Big time. But I don't understand why. I mean, we land men on the moon. You know, we can put a pig heart into a human body. I mean, we do all types of really outrageous stuff, great stuff, and yet we can't build a slaughterhouse? I mean, come on. Slaughterhouses get built in the Midwest all the time, and yet, again, these sustainable conferences, they will talk about it. But what I think they need to do is actually build the thing. They've done it. I mean, Anya Fernald is a person in Bel Campo Food on the West Coast. They built a slaughterhouse. Temple Grandin helped advise it. Temple Grandin, pay her. She'll come and build the whole thing for you.
But there's resistance in many places. In fact, in New York City, there were a number of live poultry mm-hmm. places. Pretty much all of them have been closed down, partly because people in the neighborhoods don't want them.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then we, you know, eat turkeys that suffer, you know, I mean, at the same time. So these are uncomfortable things. I think we're still hampered a little bit by the effects of PETA and the vegetarian movement and Paul McCartney, and we need to liberate ourselves and say that if things are going to get better, these are the things we have to do, like it or not. And, you know, all these great social movements.
You're angry with Paul McCartney?
What's that? Well, I mean, if
didn't he write Yesterday's?
Yeah, no, just this aspect of him. But if he had spent his time fighting for humane animal raising rather than vegetarianism, the Carnivore's Manifesto would probably never have had to be written.
On the other hand, talking about vegetables, you talk a lot about supporting CSAs.
Mm-hmm. CSAs are very important. One of the chapters is a joke title, "Sleep with Your Butcher and Maybe Your Bartender." If you don't shop consistently at 5 places, you're probably not really part of the sustainable food movement, which might shock a lot of people that do all their shopping at one place, Whole Foods or something, and think they're doing it right. But it's important to support the cheesemonger who, you know, ages the cheeses in a certain way and can put more attention to things, to be part of a CSA, which, talk about breaking off the grid, that is the best way. You're putting your money down before the food is raised. You're committed with the farmer, and they deliver it to the neighborhood.
We've seen the growth of farmers markets all over the country. In New York, I think the first one was Union Square.
Mm-hmm.
Now that whole area is changing, and Danny Meyer has to close down a restaurant that was to some degree inspired by the proximity of the farmers market.
Yes, I mean, that farmer's market is it's a very interesting place. I mean, I have issues with the green market. I mean, I think they should serve food like they do at the Ferry Plaza.
Or in Europe, in many of the markets.
Yeah, people stay for lunch. They stay for the whole day. They bring their kids. If you've ever been to Ferry Plaza, you're like, why can't this happen in New York? And the answer is, well, they don't want to hurt the local businesses. Well, those local businesses, there are a lot fewer city bakeries and Union Square cafes around, and they're mostly now, you know, McDonald's or Subway. So let's start take the fight to the big companies, and let's start giving people lunch there, not just raw food.
Can you talk about the Museum of Food and Drink? Is that ever going to actually be created?
Yes, Museum of Food and Drink is MOFAD, and it is conceived by Dave Arnold, who is really a genius, and he conceived it with his very good friend, the late Michael Batterbury, who is a very good friend of mine, too. And it's hard to convince people to invest in a concept that's not going to exist for 5 years. But essentially, we have museums for everything, from balls of twine, and every major city in the world has a museum dedicated to wild animals, natural history museums. And yet, there is not one food museum in the world.
So what would you have in there?
Well, I mean, I would like to have, well, Dave's ideas are he would like to do, you know, the history of fermentation would be a big exhibit. And it would be just like the Natural History Museum, a huge room where you touch and you taste. He wants to do a big exhibit on that. You know, I personally brought this idea up, taxidermy, where people see 80 breeds of cow. But, you know, they have many, many great ideas.
He even has a cannon that puffs up rice.
Yeah, cereal. That's their first exhibit. It's the cereal exhibit, and it's called the Puffer, and it uses an outdated piece of technology that literally explodes grain into puffy cereals, and it's a lot of fun. It tastes delicious, and it gets people to understand something. I think probably more cereal boxes are consumed than they are livestock in this country every year, so it's a huge issue, but people don't think about their food in the same way that they do art or architecture.
People like to make fun of hipsters and all the artisanal goods that are being created in Brooklyn a lot, and some other places, but now associated largely with Brooklyn. Do they have a real impact on food culture?
Well, I mean, the thing that we say about the hipsters is, you know, that every culture, every generation has a problem with the generation before it and after it. And no group was ridiculed more than the hippies, but remember, almost everybody was a hippie in some way. You know, some started Apple computers, some went on to the White House, but, you know, hipsters are basically making huge contributions to bringing great food to the American public without the white tablecloth.
Is that why you've started Heritage Radio in Hipster Central? Bushwick?
Hipster Central, yeah. I mean, we believe that these guys, you know, who do things quietly, you know, make cocktails with outrageous formulas in it, and, you know, that they are actually making huge contributions to gastronomy. I mean, the food truck scene is probably a hipster scene to a certain extent.
What are you doing that's different than food TV?
What are we doing?
Yeah, on Heritage Radio.
You know, this is, you know, we've said one of the things that this book says is, you know, that if you were to pick the top five issues of our time, you know, as relates to food, you know, global warming, antibiotics in the food supply, loss of family farms, you know, weather changes, things like that. Most of those are ignored by food sections or by food magazines.
And by many politicians.
Yes, and by food television, almost 100%. I mean, I have great respect for the Food Channel, of course, but I'm pretty sure that literally 0% of their content is dedicated to serious issues that might help farmers like the ones we work sleep better at night. So Heritage Radio is a very small artisan endeavor, and yet we're trying to give voice to these issues that sometimes you have to look to the business section to get stories about the types of things we bring up. But, you know, from Dave Arnold to Linda Palacio to an Animal Instinct show, you know, we try to give voice to things that possibly are not mainstream enough to merit, you know, a 12-2 spot on NPR.
You're also not doing an Iron Chef segment.
No Iron Chefs.
But you're talking about the things on radio that you're talking about in this book, with essays supplied by a number of different people. Or did you write the whole thing?
No, I wrote the whole thing. I was very lucky over the years to work with Carlo Petrini and Alice Waters, and I got a chance to write down all these little snippets, but I couldn't write the book until I met Mike Edison.
Carnivore's Manifesto, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat is published by Little Brown. Patrick Martins, thank you so much for being on our show.
A real honor. Thank you, Leonard.